Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Hour 2 of your Tuesday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka joins us in just about 30 minutes. Curtis Ellis going to tell us why the Vice President is coming to town tomorrow, and you can go see him.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
We're going to hang with him.
We're going to talk to Curtis Ellis at 8, Pete Hegseth at 8:35. Real quick, before we get into this, is out of the Washington Post. So everybody was all afraid of Trump's rhetoric when it came to trade and the tariffs and the trade war. Well, you know, it's having some effect. South Korea has agreed to open up its auto market in return for an exemption from steel tariffs. Seoul and Washington are hailing an agreement to revise their free trade deal as a win-win after South Korea agreed to further open its auto market, and the Trump administration said it would not impose steel tariffs on the country.
What cars does South Korea make? What
yours?
Is my Kia South Korean?
I believe so, yeah.
Awesome. I love South Korean technology. I thought that was the case, but I wasn't 100%. I wasn't 100% sure. I love my Kia. That's awesome.
Yeah, I off the top of my head, I don't remember others, but I'm pretty sure the Kia is a South Korean vehicle.
If that's the case, then so would be Hyundai.
I believe that is accurate as well.
Yeah. All right. Out of Miami Herald. We'll go here. Amid a wide gap between modest teacher salaries and Miami's high housing prices, the county has a new plan, Drew. Build apartments on school property and let the faculty live there.
I'm sure it will just be luxurious.
I don't really have a good reason why this seems like a horrible idea, but this seems like a horrible idea. The preliminary proposal includes constructing a new mid-rise middle school with a floor devoted to residential units and several more reserved for parking and the classrooms on top. If that goes well, Miami-Dade wants a full-fledged housing complex next to Phyllis Wheatley Elementary with as many as 300 apartments going up on campus just north of downtown. One of the housing directors says it's an exciting idea. The land is at a premium in Miami-Dade County. It's difficult to come by, especially in their urban core.
There's no place left to build anything in Miami-Dade.
Really?
In that whole area. The last time I was down, I grew up in Miami. And the last time I was down there, I was blown away at how much sprawl had taken place. I mean, it would basically the entirety of the South Florida coast is all urban and metro areas now. It's crazy.
They said the residential and educational facilities could share some of the recreational facilities after hours, such as playing fields or community rooms. The buildings would be designed, however, so that residents and school populations couldn't mix during the school day. At one particular building, students and residents would enter in different ground floor lobbies and use different elevators. At Phyllis Wheatley, the school would be in one building and the apartments would be in another. I don't know.
I just feel like there's so many things that could go wrong here. I don't know what, but
yeah, I like that separation, and I really don't have like a good justification for it. I could see it if they can make it so it's affordable and it would make sense for some teachers.
It feels almost gulag-ish.
Yeah.
You will work here, and you will live here.
Right.
And this is where you will be.
Well, what happens if these teachers have families, too? I mean, are they making, like, are they like, small studio apartments for single teachers, and then they can move out if they want to, like, have a family? Or are these, like, small apartments that are going to support families? That's going to also add a lot of people to the area, to
and
the school.
And when you think about bad behavior, you know, and I hate to go down that road, but when you think
that
about...
That was one of my first
thoughts, inappropriate student-teacher relations,
Rampant.
Yeah, all right.
Nobody wants to talk about it, so, but
exactly.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
That's the part of it that, and Sam, I'm with you. The first time I went, let's not create a situation where everybody's, exactly.
Tutoring session. I don't like it.
Well, you go Miami-Dade.
They're using it as a recruiting tool because the cost of living in Miami and Miami-Dade County is through the roof. And when it comes to recruiting new teachers, that's the big hurdle. They can't get teachers to move there because they can't afford to live there.
Nope. Yeah. I get it. It just has that creepy factor. I don't particularly like it. All right. I don't like this either, but we're going to get into it. So last week, was it last week? Or is it like the week before last now? The Catherine Kirsten's
last week. Yeah.
Early in the week.
It was early in the week.
Right.
We talked about it on Monday. We had her on the show on Wednesday, I believe. And there were two counterpoints that had come out between the time that her article came out and we had her on. We had her on to respond to all the counterpoints that the Star Tribune kept printing. We thought it was done.
Right. Well, and again, this was Center of the American Experiment, Catherine Kirsten, and she penned an editorial where she gets into the Obama-era guidelines that were put forward to school districts, talking about how there are the disciplinary rates among minority students, the percentages are off, right? And again, as a background, we've seen this happen already. I've lived in the largest school district in Arizona had the same types of practices where if you had two students who both broke whatever rule the school had, one student would be treated differently based off of the color of their skin than another student was, all in an attempt to go and get the racial disparities to even up when it comes to disciplinary practices and suspension rates. It's a real horrible model to have. Everybody should be treated the same. They should be disciplined the same.
Yeah.
43 letters were sent to Minneapolis or to Minnesota schools, where they were told that they were under federal investigation for potentially breaking these Obama-era guidelines, and we don't know what schools got them.
Yeah, we don't know what's in the letters. We don't know what schools got them. We know the Dayton administration just sent them out. That's all we know at this point.
And the idea here is that those that are proponents of these Obama-era guidelines talk about this systemic racism that exists. And as we've mentioned several times, the only way that that can be possible is if you have faculty within the schools that are being racist. There has to be somebody that is perpetuating this racism in the schools for there to be racism involved that lends itself to these percentages of disciplinary rates that don't match up with one another.
Right. These decisions are still being made by individuals. If you can show that that some individuals in some school have a pattern of disciplining a particular race more than any other or more harshly than other races, fire that person.
Right.
It's pretty simple.
But when you try to go and call that out, they claim that that's not the case.
Yeah.
They say that you're being racist for saying that they're claiming that the teachers must be racist. And they talk about some systemic problem outside the school district that they want to suddenly solve inside the school district. It's all very agenda driven. This is what Catherine Kirsten's editorial was about. And it was all facts. It was all facts.
It's all data.
All data.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she used data.
Counterpoint number three. This is written by Laura Gilliam. She is a Twin Cities area parent and advocate.
An advocate for what?
I don't know.
Okay, just an advocate.
Stupidity, apparently.
Are we all advocates for something?
Well, that's true. Yeah.
I'm an advocate for ponies.
Daily negative messages in our schools do more damage than one racist screed. She's now elevated to writing a racist screed. Damaging assumptions are far more common and at least as harmful as what appeared in the undisciplined commentary.
Okay, first of all, there was nothing harmful that appeared in the commentary. It was just words.
Right.
It was words and data. That Catherine Kirsten's editorial harmed nobody.
And assumptions? Are you kidding me? The whole basis of the Obama-era guidelines is assumptions.
Yeah.
Assuming that there is systemic racism that exists but apparently is not being perpetuated by any individuals. It's all based off assumptions. What Catherine put forward actually wasn't assumptions. It was fact-based.
Yeah.
It's important that state leaders, the article goes on to say, and educators continue to call out this kind of damaging and blatantly racist rhetoric when they see it. Look, they say... Look,
So now advocating for... consistent disciplinary practices, regardless of race, is blatantly racist.
Right.
Man, the world is upside down.
I know. Look, those that push in this individual and the other two editorials, they want to say that the schools are raft with racism, right? Yet they can't point to it specifically. But then when anybody goes and points that out, then you're racist.
Yeah. If you can show me that you've got racist administrators that are meting out disciplinary punishments for one race worse than others, then yeah, you found a racist. Let's get rid of him.
Right. As a parent of color, I can tell you that the painful assumptions that Catherine Kirsten made about families and children of color are just part of the problem.
Okay. It would be nice if she would articulate those assumptions. What were they? Because she just says that. The painful right. assumption that Catherine Kirsten made about families and children of color are part of the problem. Okay, what assumptions are you referring to?
Right.
Never lays those out.
It's unbelievable to me that the people writing this editorial don't realize the racism that's right in front of them. They're the ones making the assumption. They're the ones that are jumping to conclusions that Catherine Kirsten never, ever made. We can't stop with calling out her bare-faced racism. We also need to talk about the less blatant racism that Minnesota students and families experience every day. This kind of racism might not be as obvious as Ms. Kirsten's, but it's just as damaging, if not more so. It's also far more common. Now, this is where it gets real rich, okay? Ask yourself, how many times have you read articles in the last few years about students' assaults on teachers? Okay, talked about that in St. Paul, how these actual policies have led to violence in some of the schools right. because of their inability to go and crack down on students.
Yeah, they don't want to remove problem students because they don't want to run afoul of these guidelines.
On the flip side, how many times have you read stories about students being suspended for minor things, like chewing gum? Also, a real problem, but one that we seldom hear about.
Okay, it would be nice at this point if she would provide some data as to how often that's happening.
And are you really trying to say that suspensions for chewing gum are what is disproportionately affecting minority student populations?
That seems to be the point she's making.
It's dumb.
Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. We don't know because there are no indications given in this counterpoint as to how often that's happening. She just puts it out there
right.
and says it, and we are supposed to accept it at face value.
Assaults on teachers, serious offenses, deserve our outrage and action, but student removals for unnecessary or subjective reasons, which disproportionately affect students of color, deserve our attention too. When we only hear stories of kids gone wild and never about the systems that might actually be making things worse, this is subtle racism at play. And yet, to what you just said, Drew, never offered up an example. So talk about making things worse. She's making things worse by making a whole bunch of assumptions and claims without right. anything to back it up.
Without backing it up. You're right. Oh. And of course, if a child is suspended for chewing gum, of course that's not going to make the news.
Right.
You really expect the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press to write a story every time a child is suspended for some rules violation?
Yeah. And I don't think there's a bunch
but when
of...
a child assaults a teacher, yes, that's actually newsworthy.
You know, unless there is some group of bubblegum chewing scofflaws that we're not aware of that are causing these numbers to be so disproportionately out of whack. When journalists rush to break a story about the latest assault against a teacher, yet show little interest in student stories of mistreatment and being pushed out, they're reinforcing racist stereotypes.
No, they're not.
Oh, my
gosh. Because the entire assumption behind that sentence, which is a horrible assumption to make, is that the assaults are being perpetrated by minorities.
Right. Right.
That's the assumption that she made
right.
in that sentence.
Right.
That the author of this counterpoint made.
And the point that Catherine Kirsten made in her editorial several times was when she looked at various districts and how the disproportionate suspension race, the disproportionate percentages of suspension rates among student populations varied from district to district and state to state, and so did the demographics. But they never want to point that out. They don't want to talk about when it comes to Asian kids in certain districts or white kids in other districts. They only zero in on the minority populations that serves their agenda best. But subtle racism doesn't stop in the local news. It also plays out to every day within school walls. This is where I get really upset. Okay? This is where I get really upset. If you're white, ask yourself, has your child ever confided in you that they don't feel welcome or wanted at their school?
Yes.
Well, Laura Gilliam, as a matter of fact, they have.
Yeah.
My white kid just did a matter of weeks ago.
Yeah.
So get off your high horse already.
I've had that conversation.
Unbelievable to me. Ugh. I was so angry.
There are very few children that go through their school career, especially in high school, that don't have periods of time where they feel unwelcome, unwanted, outcast, bullied. I mean, you're talking about a really, really small percentage of kids that for some reason manage to navigate their school career being, you know, part of a group, part of a clique, part of a popular club, whatever. Every other kid at some point goes through periods like that.
And what we are talking about right now and what Drew just mentioned and the fact that my kid has gone through this too is the exact point that needs to be made to show why these Obama-era school guidelines are wrong. Because this type of stuff affects every single student, regardless of their skin color.
Right. But what these guidelines do is that they tell the minority students that the reason this is happening is because of your skin color.
Right.
Not every kid goes through these things. Every kid goes through periods of bullying, periods of being outcast, periods of being made fun of. It's part of growing up. It's not a fun part. You learn a lot about yourself during that part. But when you go to the kid and you say, well, that's happening to you because you're black, you're telling them that they are going to live a life of perpetual victimhood.
There is still more to get to with this. 651-989-5855. If you want to call and comment, use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter. We'll discuss more of this third round counterpoint. I think they protested too much. I think Catherine Kirsten, the center of the American experiment, may have struck a nerve. Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka joins us just after 7:30. We'll get to the latest going on inside the legislature. The response to a Star Tribune story on Governor Mark Dayton and his tax plan. We'll dive into that. Senate moves to fix the Minnesota pension plans as well. Got a number of different things we'll talk about with Mr. Gazelka. In the meantime, Drew, we are correctly tearing apart this third counterpoint to Catherine Kirsten.
Yeah.
Center of the American Experiment.
I wonder if they're going to allow any counterpoints to the counterpoints.
This could really go on in perpetuity. Probably not. Daily negative messages in our schools do more damage than one racist screed. And again, this is about Obama-era school guidelines that are telling the schools that they need to discipline students to differently based off of how disproportionate the percentage is of minority students to white students and how those percentages align when it comes to suspension and disciplinary practices.
And even if you take those policies at face value, like the intent behind those policies at face value, the net result is that schools are going to be hesitant to suspend problem kids if they fall within a minority because they don't want to run afoul of the guidelines.
Right, right.
That is the net result that is going to happen.
Laura Gilliam, Twin Cities area parent and advocate, okay, is the one who penned this article and asks a series of questions in this, right? She does say that she is a black parent of three children, asks herself, if you're white, has your child ever confided in you that they don't feel welcome or wanted at school or that their teacher told them that they would never graduate from high school? Yeah, actually had that happen.
Yeah.
Have you ever been denied a meeting with your child's teacher or school principal to discuss your concerns? Well, I haven't personally had that happen, but if you've had that happen to you, then I think you've got a pretty good complaint to take to your school district to have it taken care of.
Right.
Somebody's going to hear you.
Did you escalate that to the next level? Because if that's the case, that teacher or principal needs to be dismissed.
Right.
It's pretty simple.
Has your child ever gone a school year without a single teacher who shared the child's race?
Again, this back to this notion that kids are somehow incapable of learning from teachers that don't look like them. I spent most of my youth, especially in Miami, with a broad array of teachers. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was until I got into high school where I actually had a white male teacher.
Mm-hmm.
They were all female and
right.
of varying races.
Yeah. What about gender?
Yeah.
My child isn't taught by a man. He's taught by a woman. So does the same rules apply? I mean, if what you're going by is that the teacher can't properly go and teach the student unless they look like that student, then yes, gender should also apply. How can a white woman actually relate to my 11-year-old son?
How do you explain the success that Asian kids have in school?
Have you ever been told that teachers in your child's school are afraid of you? Again, I would think you would have recourse to go and deal with that. Yep. Have you ever felt as if educators are holding low expectations for your child because of false assumptions they're making about you as a parent? Yes.
Yep.
Yes. Absolutely. Thank you in that paragraph for laying out all the reasons why those Obama-era guidelines need to be eradicated from the school district right now. All kids deal with issues in school, and they should all be treated equally across the board. Kindness, discipline, all of it. Treat all the kids the same. And the however that teacher looks does not matter.
Right.
We can all learn from individuals regardless of how they look. What happened? We were taught that for years. Character, not skin color. And now suddenly it's just, like you said, everything's just upside down and backwards. I don't get it. I've experienced all of this and more, she writes. It might not be as in-your-face racist as Miss Kirsten's rhetoric, but it's there, and it's absolutely taking a toll. Well, what are you doing about it at your school?
Yeah.
It sounds like you go to a horrible school.
Yeah, why don't you send your kid to a different school? Find a charter school.
All the time.
Start a charter school.
Homeschool. All the time I hear people talk about the trauma kids of color are experiencing at home. As an engaged, involved, and educated parent, I find that this talk extremely offensive. Instead, I'm worried about the trauma my children experience in school. I know plenty of families of color who share this concern, as well as my frustration that this kind of trauma rarely gets any ink. Catherine Kirsten certainly didn't say that. Wasn't talking about the trauma that kids of color were experiencing at home, and she's just injecting this into the story to try to make an argument.
And are you kids of all colors, of all races, there are segments of them that experience trauma at home. Are you dismissing that and saying that's a myth just because in your family your kids aren't experiencing trauma at home? Awesome, great, good for you. It doesn't change the fact that there are a lot of kids out there that do have trauma at home.
Yes, teachers, policymakers, everyday Minnesotans need to be on the lookout for overtly racist dog whistling and be willing to push back on it publicly, quickly.
Well, first of all, if you're engaged in racist dog whistling, it's usually not overt. Like, if you're overtly racist, then you're not bothering with the dog whistling.
Right.
If you're doing the dog whistling, you're trying not to be overt.
Yeah, because... The dog whistles.
Not really an important point, but...
Dog whistles are, you know, you only dogs can hear it. It's kind of
it means you're not being overt.
You're not being overt. Right. I don't think she knows
kind of a dumb sentence.
That means the whole thing is dumb. Let's just be honest. But that needs to be the beginning, not the end of the outcry. For the sake of families like mine, please be on the lookout for more subtle, more common racist acts that occur every single day in our education system. Call it out and push back on that, too. Well, we just did, because this editorial was filled with subtle racism.
And it sounds like she needs to be calling it out, too. If those types of things are happening to her, if she's being denied meetings with principals and teachers, if her kid is being told these things, she needs to push back on it.
Yeah.
You know, again, these are all things that are being done by individuals. All of these claims that are being made, individual school administrators or teachers are making these decisions. And if you can show that there's a pattern of racism with a particular school administrator or a principal or a teacher, then that person needs to be dismissed.
That was this whole editorial was kind of a dog whistle.
KW in Minneapolis, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I finally got around to reading that article on Sunday morning.
The Catherine Kirsten piece?
Yes.
Okay.
And, well, first of all, I read the counterpoint on the same, I think, by the St. Paul superintendent, and there was a link to Kirsten, whatever name is, article, and I read that. And it, to me, my interpretation was just blatant racism. And there were like 4 points that I kind of like saw, and I said, like, how can she even state these things? But the first thing she said, Kirsten, I think, is it Kirsten or Kirsten, whatever her name is?
Kirsten.
She said, She said, on average, black students, they misbehave more. How does she know this? How does she even say that?
Did she say that outright in her piece? I don't remember that. I don't remember that quote being exactly like that in her piece.
Read our get this there, because I just wrote it down verbatim.
KW, this is really simple. You wouldn't have the Obama era guidelines in place unless those percentages were off. That's
I'm
the
not
point.
Obama era.
No. KW, that's what we're talking about. She's stating a fact. The whole reason why those Obama era guidelines of having disciplinary quotas exist to make sure that the numbers match up and there's not a disproportionate group of minority kids that are getting disciplined, you have to have in their minds a disproportionate number of individuals that are getting disciplined. So what she is stating is actual fact. So that's how she says that and why she says it.
That is not a fact. How does she know that black students are misbehaving?
It's called data.
Maybe black students are being reported as being misbehaving.
Because the schools put out this information for people to go and look at. We can't have a conversation if you're not going to admit that there's actual tangible data to back this up. If there wasn't tangible data, you wouldn't have these guidelines in place in the first place, KW.
I'm not going to admit that. Secondly, she said, also, she said, bias plays no role in racial discipline, in the racial discipline gap.
Right.
Come on.
The people that push the guidelines refuse to say how the bias is taking place. There has to be racism happening in the school for the guidelines to even exist in the first place. And yet the individuals that push for the guidelines fail to show where the racism is actually taking place inside the schools. So again, Catherine Kirsten is on point.
Third, she said 72% of African American students are born out of wedlock. So when a woman goes to the hospital to have a baby, the doctor asking, ma'am, are you married or are you single? So, you know. Then secondly, Minnesota Department of Health and Human Resources.
Yeah, KW, we are out of time. Unfortunately, I'm just going to correct the one quote because you're misrepresenting the quote. She says, tragically, black students' discipline rate is most likely higher than other students because, on average, they misbehave more. She didn't come right out and say black students misbehave more. She said that is most likely the reason why their discipline rates are higher. Unfortunately, we are out of time, and we have Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka joining us next.
Justice.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. I do appreciate KW calling in a moment ago. It's one of the few times I don't feel bad that we had to cut him off, due to time. If you're just gonna stare at facts and actual counterpoints, just say I'm just gonna dismiss that. Then I'm sorry.
Just not gonna believe it.
I just refuse. I'm just gonna stick my head in the old frozen snow and just refuse to look at any hard data or accept the counterpoints. So.
Joining us now, as he does every Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Wanted to start here with you this week. This was a tweet that was sent out by the Minnesota Senate Republicans' Twitter account. Five reasons why this Star Tribune story on taxes is fake news. And they're referencing a story written by J. Patrick Kulikin in the Star Tribune. Headline is Dayton Seeks Tax Relief for Families. I thought the Twitter account did a really good job of pushing back on what essentially amounted to the Dayton administration press release when it came to his tax plan.
As in press release, as in the Tribune of basically putting out the information. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's some of my enforcers basically that look at stuff and say, he can't say that, and that's why they put it out.
Yeah, the first tweet is number one reason why today's Star Tribune story on today's taxes is fake news. The headline says Dayton seeks tax relief for families. There's no better example of fake news than just regurgitating a press release and headline onto your front page.
Well, there are a number of things in there. One of them that they actually quote the DFL House research. It's like, well, that's really nonpartisan, so it's kind of like, the information they put out and then how they put it out, you know, implying that the governor generally is for tax reductions. And frankly, that's not true. It's typically Republicans that have consistently pushed for tax relief for individuals and businesses. And the governor often has wanted to spend more money. And when you spend more money, you have to raise more taxes to pay for it. And so we're not going to let them get credit for both sides of that narrative.
Yeah, they talk about his history of tax cuts, which is completely bogus. Most of any tax relief that's happened under the Dayton administration has actually been repealing or undoing unpopular tax increases that he had previously signed into law.
Yeah, the first 2 years that he was governor, we had the House and Senate for the first time in 40 years. Unfortunately, it was a $6 billion shortfall, so there was really no opportunity to reduce taxes, but we also did not increase taxes, but we reduced spending. And then the next 2 years, he had both House and Senate as Democrat-controlled, and they had about a $2 billion tax increase. And then the next 2 years, it was divided government again, and there was nothing going on. And then now we pushed and got signed with Republicans in the House and Senate more tax relief. But again, to say that that was where what he was directing just wasn't true.
Where are we going to land on this particular issue? There was an editorial in the Star Tribune talking about going a completely different route than even what the federal, you know, guidelines are. Where are we going to end up when it comes to taxes and aligning ourselves with the federal government and the tax system?
Yeah, so if people don't know, the federal government, the changes they made in November were the biggest changes since 1986. 90% of Minnesotans are going to get a tax reduction federally. And if we conform at the state level just to the changes, Minnesotans actually get a tax increase, both individuals and business owners. And so what we're trying to push for is at the very minimum, individuals and businesses don't get a tax increase when we conform. I would like to have more tax reductions. We'll see where the governor is on some of that stuff. But his proposal actually raised taxes $1.4 billion over the next 4 years. $400 million of that was just some of the taxes that he wanted to take away or basically bring back towards businesses. And then another billion was extending the sick tax, which is a tax on people when they go into doctors and clinics and have to pay a tax as part of their visit. And so that's where he's at. We want tax relief. You know, it's always a big tug of war, and we have a short session. So that's the part that, you know, nobody knows for sure. But I can say what we're working towards.
How, when it comes to that short session, what's the plus and minus? I mean, I'd imagine on the one hand, with a short session, you're also sort of spurned on to get stuff done quicker, obviously. But at the same time, is that pressure a good thing or is it a bad thing in your opinion?
Well, I'm really one of the two people that set that date at February 20th for a start date instead of January. And part of the thinking is, you know, it's less time for mischief. I mean, there's so many bills that get submitted, and you know, it's amazing what you can get done when you have a deadline. That was the plus side. The minus side is that you don't have a lot of time to think through some of the more complex bills. And we didn't know when we set that date that the federal tax bill was going to get passed in November, and the feds didn't even have it all figured out by the time we started in February. And so that's where it's difficult. You know, in the future, 2 years from now, when I get to set the date again, I might not do February 20th, but I'm still not going to start in January.
You should make it like a week. Just get it all done. Just don't leave.
Yeah, you go back to the 70s and earlier, and they met every other year. They didn't even
have it. Wow. So, yeah. Let's go back to that.
thought you'd like to know that one. Now you can harp on that.
Yeah.
We only need to meet every other year.
Oh, man, yeah, how great would that be?
There's no real reason why the legislature needs to meet every year.
Yeah, no offense to the work you're doing, Paul Gazelka, by any stretch, but just saying. Talk about, you know, less opportunity for mischief and just kind of put stuff in place. You know,
it we passed a 2-year budget, which is what I wish the federal government would do. You know, we passed a 2-year balanced budget, and then the next year, you know, you have the bonding bill with infrastructure. But that, you know, it's not like you couldn't do that the other year. And the other side of the argument is people will say, yeah, but we're a lot bigger now. Which
sure.
That's not always true either. But,
whatever.
Okay. Anyway. Yeah.
Government's a lot bigger now. Over the weekend, we had, of course, the March for Your Lives rallies. We had a rally at the Capitol in St. Paul, and there's a lot of people that feel like this has given the move for greater gun control measures a great deal of momentum. Yesterday, some DFL state senators are hoping the weekend rallies against gun violence can get some gun bills moving again at the Capitol. They were joined by high school students. Talk a little bit about the pressure that you guys are under there to get some gun control measures moving. I know that you've got students coming in. We talked last week about the one student that disrupted a Senate committee hearing. This is continuing to go on, but it doesn't appear as if there's still much appetite for gun control measures within the legislature. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, this is the second deadline, basically, is Thursday, where a bill has to make it through the House and the Senate or it's going to be dead. And there are some exceptions, but I would say that there's no time to actually have any significant dialogue. And what I would say is that doesn't mean we're not having conversations about it and talking about it. But in the end, you know, I'm focused on a safe and secure schools bill, which means I don't think if you actually want to pass that you would have either anti-gun legislation or pro-gun legislation attached to that. And that's what people want, you know, and that's not going to happen. But what can happen is we can focus on mental health and one of the main causes of some of these issues, and we can focus on making sure our schools are safe, you know, both in access points and police there if they want them. And that's the kind of stuff that I want to provide resources for our local schools for. And so I'm going to focus on that. I won't say we have considered whether we want to have an informational hearing on guns, but it would be both sides of the gun issue. I mean, we have people that want stand your ground, which means you have a right to defend yourself if people are trying to attack you. And so there's a number of issues that I don't mind talking about, but I don't see them actually working into legislation this year.
Well, and I just wish, and this is kind of neither here nor there, Paul Gazelka, but it, just as a statement, you know, I kind of wish that we would have these debates and conversations when there hasn't been a major event that's taken place, when there's not emotions running high that are dictating, you know, how we go in and approach this. And I think that if that were to happen, there's a better opportunity to get the safety measures that you're proposing in place. And more realistic items than what the loudest voices always try to go after at the height of emotion. And it seems like this is the only time we end up having this debate is after a major event.
Well, now you're talking like a statesman. Maybe you should be running for office.
No, goodness, no. No. I tell you what, I will if we only have to meet like once every 3 years. go that route.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll do that next year. But yeah, no, that's a really good point. And what we try to do, you know, emotion is a powerful thing. But sometimes you have knee jerk reactions when you lead by emotion. But that doesn't mean you don't think about your heart when you're working on legislation. But better not disconnect your head from the final product that you're going to pass.
One more quick one before we let you go. Out of the Pioneer Press, tens of thousands of Minnesota state workers are going to get a raise after the House and Senate approved the negotiated contracts. Raises are worth $287 million coming to the Minnesota state workers.
That's really nice of us.
Yeah, that's really this. Yeah.
That's
do
our,
we?
That's
do,
our money.
Do we need to be that nice?
You know, it's a tough one. What I'll tell you is the administrative branch negotiates the contracts, and they come before the House and the Senate, and we're either yes or no. I mean, it's like we can't add amendments that basically say, no, you can't have that percentage raise. We can't do any of that kind of stuff. So it's basically an up or down vote. I want a Republican governor to negotiate that stuff. I think I'd get a better contract, but at the end, we also have to run government, and it's a tough call. That's the first one I voted for. I'm pretty sure that's the first one I voted for, but we did what you have to do. I do want to control spending. I want to watch the growth of FTEs or full-time employees, but that's extremely difficult to do when the executive branch is controlled by Democrats, to be frank.
We're talking with Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka. Senator Gazelka, we have a caller that has a question for you. You mind taking a call with us real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Al in Edina. Go ahead, Al.
Good morning. The reason I'm calling is you're creating all sorts of dust up with the Medicaid requirement, and I can't see how anybody thinks that's a bad idea.
Can you repeat that one more time?
He said
you're creating all sorts of dust up with the Medicaid requirement, and I can't see how that's a bad idea.
Are you talking about having the work for welfare? Is that what you're talking about?
Correct.
Yeah, that we are working on that. We should have some form of that to the governor's desk by the end of session. I think it's a great idea. A number of states do it, and really work is a gift. And if people can work, they should. It would also dramatically reduce some of the costs that we have in government that we're spending out in benefits that we shouldn't have to. And so for multiple reasons, I think it's a good idea. Lastly, I'll say we have a workforce shortage, and why not get the people that can work back into the workforce? So thank you for bringing that up.
Senator Majority Leader Paul Gazelka, thank you so much for your time this morning. Always enjoy our conversations, and we'll catch up with you again next Tuesday.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
Thank you, sir. All right, coming up tomorrow, America First Policies is making its 10th stop on its tax cuts to put America First tour, happening at the Minneapolis Convention Center. And Vice President Mike Pence is actually going to be at the event.
We'll talk with Curtis Ellis, one of the organizers of the event, next. He'll tell us what to expect from the Vice President's visit to Minneapolis tomorrow. Justice.